What we find is that those people who do the training also have a fire in their belly. So not only do they do, you know, what is within the role of a mental health first aider, but they also start trying to affect change within their teams, making sure that, you know, awareness days are making sure that people are thinking about well-being in a range of different ways and creating that sort of ripple effect, both within their workplaces, but also within their communities.
Hey everyone, this is Ben Morton and a very warm welcome to episode 31 of the show. In this episode, we're joined by Simon Blake, who is the CEO of the social enterprise Mental Health First Aid England, whose mission is to improve the mental health of the nation. He's also the deputy chair of the LGBT charity Stonewall, a member of the Sleep Charity Advisory Committee, and a companion of the Chartered Management Institute. Simon was awarded an OBE in recognition of his services to the voluntary sector and young people. And outside of work, he describes himself as a reluctant runner, a massive dog lover, and an enthusiastic horse rider. I found my conversation with Simon absolutely fascinating as we at one point zoomed right into the micro, the day-to-day things that we can be doing to promote good mental health in the workplace and beyond, before then zooming right back out to the macro. And when we zoomed out, Simon spoke so passionately and incredibly knowledgeably about some of the cultural and systemic problems that are impacting upon the mental health of everybody, but especially those in minority groups. He really did share a viewpoint that I've not considered in that much detail before, if at all. So, without any further delay, folks, please enjoy what I found to be an incredibly eye-watering conversation with Simon Blake. Simon, a very warm welcome to this episode of the podcast. It's great to have us with you today. And can I just start off by asking, how are you? How are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm really good. Thank you. It's a good day. The sun is shining. Had a nice restful weekend. And thank you very much for having me.
Good. And as we're recording, spring has just started, which seems to bring all sorts of opportunity and hope, right?
Absolutely. I mean, daffodils, sheep, the baby lambs, you know, all sorts of things that you just see about. But also, yeah, as lockdown eases a bit, you're hearing children in schools and all of those sorts of things, which just, you know, make the heart sing a bit.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. My office where I'm recording is right next to a school. So when I nip out to get a coffee, to hear the sound of like children laughing and giggling and screaming in the playground after it being quiet for so long, it is really, really nice to hear, I must say, especially as a parent of a daughter who's just gone back to school.
Yeah, and similarly, I live about 50 metres away from an FE college, and just that sort of excitement and joy and noise that goes with the beginning and the end of the day and lunchtime just makes it feel as though perhaps, you know, we're starting to edge our way quietly back to or forward, you know, to whatever it is comes next. So yeah, lots of things to look forward to, hopefully.
Fantastic. And Simon, let's dive into some of the questions and all of the good stuff that people are going to be eager and waiting to hear and learn from you. Can you start off, please, just by telling us a little bit about how your career journey has evolved, how that has really shaped you as a leader, and perhaps two of the main leadership lessons you've learned along the way?
Sure. So I went to college to do psychology, with the intention of training to be a psychologist. And I took a year out and, you know, traveled to America following love. That went wrong, came back, got a job in a bar, didn't ever go back to university to finish the training, but got a wonderful job as a sex education community worker, working specifically with young men in the South Wales Valleys. I'd been to university at Cardiff. And that project was one of the only projects focusing specifically on young men in the UK at that time, which made me an expert. And I then spent another 20 years or so in sexual health, personal social health education, working at the National Children's Bureau, working at Brooke, the Young People's Sexual Health Charity, National Union of Students, and then before coming to Mental Health First Aid England. So primarily organisations working around social justice and specifically around trying to address issues around inequalities and inclusion. Yeah, at the same time, I've also been a trustee of the Black Health Agency, chair of Diversity Role Models, and I'm vice chair of Stonewall, the LGBT charity. So that vein of social justice, you know, ringing right the way through everything. I don't think I'm ever going to go back and become a qualified psychologist now as I approach my 50s. But what I have got is a really strong commitment to focusing on tackling inequalities, promoting social justice. Yeah, mental health is a social justice issue, and really trying to create a more equitable society. You know, we've seen all sorts of issues over the last year with regards to inequalities in relation to race and racism, gender inequalities. We know inequalities in relation to trans people, etc. So there's a huge amount of work that needs to be done around equity, inclusion, and diversity. In terms of my two leadership lessons, one, always employ people who are better than you to work with you, different skills, you know, more skilled in order to help, and never be afraid of ensuring that people who are much better than you, who are in your team, and make sure you listen to them and their skills as well. And I guess the second part of that is making sure that those people are not all the same as you, that there are different life experiences, different backgrounds, different ethnicities, sexualities, different perspectives on the world, because that makes your decision making so much richer. And then the other is really, I guess, that you will never, ever have all the perfect information. You can only make decisions based on what you know at any one time, and that part of being a good leader is recognizing that, being vulnerable, being compassionate, being human, acknowledging when you make mistakes, and ensuring that when the mistakes are made, they're your mistakes, and when the credit is due, you make sure that it's given to those around you who've helped make that happen.
Well, thank you. Some great leadership lessons there. It's interesting. There's lots of real themes emerging there, especially around the sort of hiring people who are better than you, really about listening as well, which I think can sometimes be hard for leaders to do, right? Because it's easy to think, because I'm the leader and we've got X years experience, sort of I know best. But I think that's a pretty dangerous mindset, right?
Well, it's very old-fashioned, isn't it? The leader, the command and control, the I'm in the leadership position and therefore I know what needs to be done. For me, being a leader is knowing the questions to ask rather than knowing the answers to the questions. And of course, if you talk to a number of people that have worked with me over time, and they've come and said, what's the answer to this? I'm like, You have so much more expertise and so much more skill than me. We can talk that through, but your judgment, your expertise is really, really vital here, and to trust that and to trust people around you. And actually, I guess the thing which is important to say in that is it's not always easy to do that. So that's, if I'm asked a question, I quite often have an opinion, and so I have to stop myself from giving an answer. So that principle and my absolutely firm belief about involving others, trusting others, making sure that that skill and expertise is used, can sometimes rub with a personality which is ask me a question and I'll have a view about it. So it's really trying to understand the situation, understand yourself, have that level of awareness and humility, isn't it? That has to be, in your toolkit as a leader, being, the humility, the willingness to say when I've got it wrong. And those are not necessarily things which were traditionally associated with leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the point where regular listeners of the show are going to chuckle, because here comes my first off-piste question. But I'm really interested around this questioning piece you touched on. It's something I'm working on a lot myself, especially as a podcaster, also my facilitation work. And it's sort of based on the saying, I don't know who first coined this, if indeed anybody, but it's sort of, if you want better answers or better outcomes, learn to ask better questions. Is sort of learning the art of asking great questions to get great answers from those that you've led in the past, is that something that you've consciously kind of worked on? And if so, how? Or is it just something that you think has naturally evolved for you, Simon? What's that looked like?
I think it requires us having relationship, doesn't it? It requires us having good relationships with the people that we work with in order that we can keep asking the questions. And I remember when I worked with Jules Hillier, who's now the chief exec of a brilliant charity called Pause. And she would just say, you know, you just keep asking questions until I find the answer. And the reason that I could do that was because we had a really, really strong relationship in which she was my direct report, but would challenge, guide, direct, lead, manage up in all sorts of brilliant ways. And I think I learned from that feedback that if you've got the good relationships, or if you work to build the good relationships, then you can keep asking the good questions, or the questions which are going to help. And of course, you know, some of the most difficult things which we have to deal with, you know, working in organizations, if you think about the last year in relation to COVID, or you know, working on really difficult social justice issues, you know, the answer isn't obvious. And so it is about finding the answer through conversation, through questions, and for questions to become conversations, there has to be a level of relationship. And that's, I guess, another leadership lesson is, whatever your personal beliefs, the differences that you may have in styles, in personalities, in approaches to things, that building relationships that are based on trust and respect, and coming into those conversations with that expectation that you will ask each other questions, that you will challenge each other, that you will disagree, but you will do that in pursuit of the right answer or the best answer at any one time, I think is really, really important. And we often talk, don't we, about, you know, conflict is really important. And I think we perhaps should stop thinking conflict is really important, because the actual definition of conflict, you know, is slightly problematic when it comes to, you know, really what we're saying is not that there should be conflict, but that we should be welcoming different views into the space, and we should trust that having those different views will help to find the better answer. The nature of conflict suggests that one person will have their view, the other person will have their view, or the other people will have their views until one person wins. Whereas having different viewpoints and different perspectives is really about us finding the best solution once you've considered all of those different perspectives.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Simon. I'm a big fan of his work, but I think this idea of conflict in the workplace was popularized by Patrick Lencioni and his work around the five dysfunctions of a team. And I absolutely kind of love the premise that sits behind it. But I share your view, I think, that the word conflict can at times be quite unhelpful. I think kind of what we're talking about is kind of what you've shared, or thinking about it in terms of healthy challenge instead of conflict, or respectful challenge. But yeah, absolutely kind of 100% agree with you. Simon, I'd love to pick up on this piece that you've mentioned several times around social injustice, especially because when we spoke last week, you touched on something that I've not personally given that much thought to at all previously. And that was really around the impact that our race, our gender, our sexual orientation or skin color might have upon our mental health, especially in the workplace. And for example, I think it's no one comes as any surprise to anybody, it's not new news that in many organizations and sectors, I think if you're a white heterosexual male, you're likely to face less challenges progressing your career than if you're a woman, or if you're an individual from one of the minority groups. I'd love just if you could kind of talk to us about that a little, if you can, and almost share some of what you said to me when we caught up last week, because it was so, so powerful, I think.
The really important thing is to recognise that those inequalities exist in the workplace, that we know that they exist because, you know, it's reflected in the gender pay gap, it's reflected in the ethnic pay gap, it's reflected in who you see in the boardrooms, it's reflected in who you see in senior positions and who you don't see in senior positions, in who gets promotions and who does get heard and who doesn't get heard, and what people wear to work and how they express themselves at work. And where we at MHFA England are really, really clear is that if we are going to feel able to contribute our best at work, if we're going to build our best relationships, if we're going to feel as though our contribution is valued, that affects the whole of the organisation. And we know that, you know, that isn't the experience for some people at the moment, whether people feel able to wear piercings to work, whether people feel they're going to be judged if they talk their first language on a personal phone call, whether people believe that they can wear clothes which reflects their personality or their hair colour. And we know that, you know, women get less airtime often within meetings. We know that there are, you know, more white people in the senior positions. And all of those things are going to affect well-being at work. And of course, what the research also shows is that where organisations have greater diversity, where people feel as though their voices are valued, where people feel as though they can take their whole self to work, which is, you know, the campaign which we run at MHFA England, they're much more able to operate at the edge of their brilliance. They're much more able to feel connected. They feel better at work. They feel better able to contribute. And so that basic premise of having opportunities, having equitable experiences, it being fair, and that people can bring parts of themselves to work without fear of judgment, without fear of sanction, without fear that it will impact on their career opportunity, you know, has to be good for individuals, but it also has to be good for business as well.
Yeah, amazing. I just got to say, I love that phrase you use that I think I've heard before, operate at the edge of their brilliance. What a fantastic saying.
Well, it takes a lot, doesn't it? You know, so I'm a gay man. If I had to go to work and pretend or feel worried about whether I was going to say that I'd been to X pub at the weekend rather than a more general statement, or I'd had to be worried that if I said he instead of partner or they or instead of she or whatever language I would use around pronouns, I'm on edge. You know, and so half of my brain is going, okay, protect yourself, protect yourself, protect yourself, whilst the other part is focused on work. You know, that is the same for all sorts of people, that they're going, I've got to protect myself, I've got to behave in particular ways, I've got to fit in, I can't do it in that way. And if people are concentrating on protecting themselves, they can't operate, you know, on the edge of their brilliance. And that's where innovation happens. That's where we're at our most productive. It's where we, you know, can bring joy into the workplace. It's where we can ask for help when we need it, or we can offer help. So it is absolutely fundamental. And I think it's so, so important for all of us to recognise. You know, we've had some real, real reminders over the last couple of years, yeah, about the impact of structural racism, about the impact of structural gendered inequalities, about the institutionalized homophobia, transphobia, around disability. So all of those things all exist. And I think the most important thing that we can do is acknowledge that they exist, acknowledge that we need to do the work, acknowledge that, you know, we need to think about effective allyship in the workplace. We need to think about effective sponsorship in the workplace. We need to think about changing the ratio of people, you know, holding those positions. And it means that we've got to think about every single thing that we do and how does that uphold the status quo, and what do we need to do differently to try and create more diverse work environments in which everybody feels able to contribute. Well, first of all, feel able to get the jobs. We know that even at that start, at that point, you know, there are some barriers, but that we remove those barriers all the way through the organisation, everything that we do.
Yeah, amazing. And following that thread, Simon, so whilst mental health first aid training can help, and I'm a huge fan of it, having done mine just before Christmas, and we'll talk a little bit more about that shortly, if that's okay. I think it's true that that will only sort of deal to a certain degree, right, with issues, mental health issues, once they have arisen. And yes, it potentially allows mental health first aiders to spot some signs and intervene early. But following on from what you've said, what it doesn't really do is address some of the more systemic causes, right, of poor mental health in the workplace and the broader society, all that stuff you've just been speaking about. So from your view, from Mental Health First Aid kind of England, what do you think are some of some of the most important things that leaders of organisations could be doing to start to address that and remove some of those injustices?
The first thing is that this has to be a boardroom conversation. Yeah, it has to start at the top. We won't deal with these issues of inequality within the workplace and with the wider society by them being a side project or a project which, you know, somebody without the ability to make things happen. The second is that this has to be an issue that is dealt with and taken responsibility by everybody, that too often the responsibility of people who given as responsibility to those who experience those inequalities. So this has to be a boardroom issue with senior sponsorship, with commitment to resourcing, commitment to making sure that allies, people with that strategic responsibility, are not those who are left experiencing those inequalities. I think then it's got to be seen as a business imperative. You know, it's a moral purpose, it has a social justice purpose, but it also has a business purpose. And all of the evidence shows that diverse workplaces where staff feel valued are really able to perform better than others. And then mental health and well-being needs to be thought about, along with diversity and inclusion, in everything that we do. Yeah, that we must think about things like the gender pay gap and about the ethnic pay gap as part of programs around well-being, around improving diversity and inclusion, about making sure that when we're recruiting into board positions and that we're thinking about diversity, when we're thinking about, you know, recruiting to senior positions, but also when you're thinking about, you know, who gets what support and sponsorship and opportunities, you know, who is it, making sure that those barriers to structural barriers that stop people progressing are removed as much as possible. Mental health first aid training is one small part of an overall organisational approach to promoting well-being and thinking about diversity and inclusion. And, you know, so it has to be, you know, senior leaders, managers, mental health first aiders, a level of awareness across the organisation. But what I think it is important to be really clear about is that whilst people who are trained in mental health first aid and then take on a role as mental health first aider, and I'm delighted that you've done the training so sort of understand this, is what we find is that those people who do the training also have a fire in their belly. So not only do they do, you know, what is within the role of a mental health first aider, but they also start trying to affect change within their teams, making sure that, you know, awareness days are held, making sure that people are thinking about well-being in a range of different ways and creating that sort of ripple effect, both within their workplaces, but also within their communities. But I think it's really, really important just to be absolutely explicit. Equality, diversity and inclusion and the relationship and the impact of social inequalities and its link to, you know, the impact of oppression on mental health is really, really important to understand, to make those links. But we must also just ensure that we are not leaving this sort of change and work, you know, if people experience racism are trying to tackle racism within the workplace, that's clearly not, you know, the right way about doing this. It's about white allies and leadership taking responsibility for trying to eradicate that. The same around gender inequalities. You know, it isn't for women to constantly be tackling the issues around gender inequalities or LGBT people around those inequalities, disabled people, etc. This is about organisational-wide strategies and approaches which everybody feels as though they're responsible for, and that people are trained and have the tools to be able to address that. And then mental health first aid is exactly as you say. It's about trying to identify signs and symptoms and provide support to people who may need particular help, but also recognising that as people who've had training in mental health, in the same way that might have had training in other forms of mental health, people often feel incredibly passionate and do huge amounts within their teams and organisations to try and shift the culture, to try and create more open cultures, to try and eradicate the stigma that's still associated with mental health.
And again, carrying on that thread, Simon, kind of the reason this podcast came about was because I saw your picture and read the introduction that in the mental health first aid manual when I did my course. In the foreword that you wrote, if you can remember it, you said in there that when you did your training, I think it said back in 2018, that you wish you'd done it 20 years earlier because the knowledge and skills you learned could have made a huge difference in both your professional and personal life. Just wonder if you could elaborate on that for us a little bit and tell us what you mean, share some examples maybe, because I'm sure people would be fascinated to hear that.
I've done a lot of mental health training over my career, and most of it's been awareness training. Most of it's been about, you know, making sure that we don't judge, making sure that we try to contribute to, you know, reducing the stigma that's associated with mental health. What I'd never really had before was training which helped me to really understand about mental health, about mental health conditions and around some of the impacts at a level that I was able to understand, and a level at which I was able to understand what I could do as a friend, as a partner, as a manager, and as a leader. And yeah, I have been in numerous situations with friends and partners who have experienced poor mental health, mental illness, or had suicidal thoughts and taken their own lives. And there are moments where I could have done things very, very differently. And I didn't have the knowledge and I didn't have the skills. And the same would be true in the workplace, where I could have done things differently. I like to believe that I've always operated with the best intention, that I've always operated with compassion, and I've made some really good decisions and been a brilliant manager to some people in certain circumstances, you know, where they've experienced mental distress, mental illness. But I've also got it wrong. And of course, the important thing about all of this is that when we do training, and particularly training where you think, oh my goodness, if I'd known something differently, that person might still be alive. Yeah, that's hard to absorb and that's hard to understand. But that's what I'm talking about in this, that I could have acted differently. And I, you know, think that at least positively have impacted on people's experience. Including my current partner. That sounds awful when you say current partner, including my husband, and you know, who at times has experienced me not knowing how on earth to respond to their depression or their anxiety. And of course, I still don't have all of those answers, but I'm better. I'm better because of the training, and I hope that I'm better in the workplace also. And that's true around understanding around different inequalities and the impact of racism and the impact of sexism and the impact of homophobia and ableism as well, that over time, you know, that of course you bring those things together and hope that you are constantly becoming both a better person, but also a person who is better able to deploy their skills, their emotional intelligence. And I can absolutely categorically say that, yeah, I started at MHFA England at the beginning of October in 2018, and I am an infinitely better person than I was when I started because of what I've learned about self-care, about mental health, about mental wellness, about workplace leadership, and about the ability to try to hold that sort of compassionate understanding of mental health and mental illness and workplace cultures and workplace performance. Now, yeah, have I got an incredibly long way to go? Yes, absolutely. But am I a lot further down the line than I was 2 or so years ago? Absolutely. And that course was pivotal. Yeah, it really, really was one of those moments when I thought, well, this changes so much about how I understand my response and how I should be responding in particular circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, just a couple of reflections of mine from when I completed my training that I share with the aim of helping to spread the word about the course and sell it in inverted commas. But some of the big things for me were, I think number one, it dispelled a lot of myths or corrected a lot of false beliefs, assumptions, truisms that I held. So like some of the classics are self-harm is a cry for help, where actually it's not, because a lot of people who self-harm will go to great lengths to cover it up and prevent anyone from knowing. So there's lots of aha moments like that. And I mean, the other thing it did for me was I suddenly realized when I've sort of been in a situation where I could have helped somebody who was struggling with their mental health, there's probably lots of things I could have said that I didn't, because I felt it was the wrong thing to say. So it's just really, really powerful in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the important bit, isn't it? That it dispels myths. It helps us to understand stigma. It helps us to understand the limits of what we can and can't do, but the importance of leaning into conversations and making sure that we do the best we can to signpost and to ensure that anybody who needs support gets it. But I think the other bit, which is often less talked about, is it also helps us to think about how we check in with ourselves, how we understand our own self-care, how we understand how much we can do to look after our own mental health. And I often talk about looking after our brains so our brains can look after us. And there's all sorts of information available on mhfaengland.org website about that. But that is also a really important part of this. If we can help shift cultures where we understand how to look after, check in with ourselves, it will better help us to be able to do that with others too.
Yeah, absolutely. Healthy mind in a healthy body, right?
100%.
Simon, I'm conscious I want to be respectful of your time. So just perhaps a few quick fire questions to finish up, if we may. How do you continue to grow and develop as a leader? What does that look like for you?
Listening a lot, talking a lot, getting feedback a lot, looking at, reading, watching, emulating, copying, stealing ideas, thoughts. Yeah, there's so much information available, but I often listen to people and think the way that they did that is something which I want to learn from and try to understand that and reflect on that. And I'm confident in saying to somebody, I watched you do that the other day and I think you did it for X, Y, and Z reason. Can I just talk that through? I'm also always clear with my team and with others that brutal honesty can be very, very kind, because it also means that we can develop and grow. So I've always asked people to feedback, but 10-minute TED Talks, quick scanning of Harvard Business Review. I get the Harvard Business Review management tip of the day. There are three or four times a month, there are some really interesting articles in that. But then I've also got the WhatsApp groups. What would 2020 have looked like if we didn't have our WhatsApp groups with people asking and helping, asking for help, supporting one another, sharing ideas? And so, the social sector is really, really lucky to have amazing, amazing leaders. And I'm privileged to call them friends and colleagues. And I'm in a couple of WhatsApp groups where we share and learn from that as well.
And Simon, I've had so many emails and social media messages over the past 4 weeks from leaders saying they're feeling exhausted and like they're heading towards burnout. They know their team are asking me for advice to better kind of lead and look after their teams. Can you share one tip or example that you've been doing in that area that might be useful for people listening?
So I have a dog, and Yeah, the dog for me is an incredibly important time, and I try to not take my phone out when I walk the dog. That's important. I also, my most enjoyable hobby I haven't been able to do for the last 6 months or so because of lockdown, and that's horse riding. So what I have done is try to find some things which are alternatives. So whether that is trying to do some stuff with nature, trying to do some things with colouring, been doing some short courses which I find learning, and one of them around horse welfare, because that's where, you know, my passions are. But I think the other thing which I would just say that I've tried to be better at is accepting that doing nothing is actually a good use of time when you need rest. And I'm appalling at that. And I'm particularly appalling at that at the weekend. But I really think that, you know, we have to acknowledge that, you know, the last 12 months have been tough for everybody, really, really unbelievably tough for some people, for all sorts of reasons. Of course, some people not living in safe homes and all of those sorts of things. But it has been tough for everybody. And perhaps one of the things which we all need to take from here is, how do we actually properly switch off? How do we make sure that we allow our brains to properly rest? And, you know, for me, that would be horse riding normally. I can't do that. So what is it that enables you to do it? And how do you create spikes of joy during your day? And that will be different for everybody. But one of the things I've also taken to is writing cards to people, because I know when I've had some cards or, yeah, a little gift through the post in this last 6-9 months, it's really brightened up a day, and some days have been really gloomy. So anything which you think will give you joy is really important, but also thinking about how you can create joy for others, because in itself that also creates some joy for you too.
And final question, Simon, what would you say is the one or maybe two books that you've read that have really had the biggest impact upon you?
I think Good to Great, and I can't remember the author.
Jim Collins,
yeah. is an old classic, which sort of sits there and is a really, really important book, which everybody should have. Creating a Thinking Environment, Nancy Klein's books from many, many years ago. But more recently, I think the Reniedo Lodge, Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People Around Race. Yeah, a number of books. And I think for now, the books that leaders should really be reading are lots of those around inequalities and social justice issues, and thinking about how we apply that lens of justice into our workplaces and our workspaces and our leadership.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Simon, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your experience, insights, and I think above all, your passion really for your work and expertise. I'm sure everybody's going to get a great deal of value from this episode, and there's so much food for thought in amongst what you shared. So on behalf of myself and everybody listening, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks very much. And just again to say that there's loads of information about mental health on our website, mhfaengland.org. Please do take a look. And thanks, Ben, very much for having me.
It's been an absolute pleasure. One thing I forgot to ask, if people want to get in touch with you, obviously you shared the mental health first aid kind of link there, but how can people get in touch with you if they want to?
So on Twitter at Simon A. Blake or CEO@mhfaengland.org is a website that is always monitored and checked, and very happy for people to get in touch with me there.
Amazing. Thank you very much, Simon. Have a great day, and thanks once again for joining us.
Thanks very much.
I hope you found that conversation valuable, folks, but most importantly, I really hope that you're able to go away and make some small positive changes as a result. If you did get value from this episode, then please do rate, review, and subscribe via iTunes, as it really does enable us to keep bringing you more and more interviews with fantastic leaders and subject matter experts. Do also visit ben-morton.com, where you can connect with me, find out more about my leadership mentoring and team development work, along with details of all of my online programs via the tools and resources page. That's it for this episode. See you again in the next one very soon, and lead on.